Chapter 3 Paradise. To seek glory and battle is glorious emerged high above the planet's southern continent, almost two-thirds of the way to the pole. Jumping in there had caught the Ruhar defenders badly out of position. They had been deployed to protect the northern continent where all the important Ruhar facilities were. That was also where the Ruhar population was concentrated. Only a handful of Ruhar were stationed on the southern continent to monitor the humans there. The Ruhar Task Force commander acted quickly, ordering three of his ships to climb up to jump distance so they could surround the enemy vessel. This took less than a minute, during which time the other Ruhar ships fired masers and missiles at the enemy. The masers would very likely miss, and the missiles would likely be intercepted by the enemy frigate's defensive masers, but the Ruhar action would keep the enemy busy. The Ruhar commander was puzzled when, instead of proceeding north at high speed to attack Ruhar facilities on the surface, the enemy ship suddenly fired a maser beam at the southern continent. The maser beam's focus had been tuned to broaden its area of impact. Rather than an intense, pencil-thin beam, it covered a wider area. The enemy was, for some unknown reason, targeting the humans' food supply. The maser beam was scorching fields of healthy crops and killing humans who had been caught in the open. Why were the Kristang expending resources to hit the humans, a species who had no combat power to threaten the Kristang? No matter, the Ruhar commander decided, that was a question that could be addressed later. The three ships he had assigned to deal with the enemy frigate reached jump distance and disappeared, only to re-emerge above the southern continent in three bursts of gamma radiation. The lightly armored Kristang frigate would soon be forced to withdraw. Then the Ruhar would assess the damage it had inflicted. No. A Kristang destroyer suddenly jumped in above the northern continent and immediately fired at several targets. To his shame, the Ruhar commander saw that the actions of the frigate had been intended to lure part of his force away from their normal patrol area, and he had rashly fallen for the enemy trick. Alarmed, he scrambled to redeploy his other ships and recalled two of the ships he had sent to deal with the frigate. Before the two enemy ships had been chased away, the destroyer was able to successfully hit four targets on the surface. 38 Ruhar died in the attack, and a weapons depot was also damaged. Next time, the Ruhar commander told himself, with grim determination, he would not be fooled into dividing his forces. That there would be a next time was one thing of which he was certain. Earth. The cookout with Rachel's friends was great, except they had chicken and hot dogs, no cheeseburgers, and everyone wanted to ask me about my experience with X4, what it was like on Paradise, with the Kristang be coming back, and 1,000 other questions. In every answer, I was careful to stick to the script of UNEF's cover story, and was as vague as possible with my answers. Rachel saw the pained look on my face after a while, and we bailed early. The next morning it was going to be another nice day, and she suggested we go on a trail ride with horses. Rachel said she had always been into horses. Her family had a horse when she was in high school, and she rode in some competitions, jumping, stuff like that. A long ride on the back of a horse, it wasn't my idea of a great time. We can go ride dirt bikes instead. It had been a while since I'd ridden a motorcycle. I expected it wouldn't take me long to get used to it again. When I was living at home, riding trails on a dirt bike or a snowmobile was regularly great fun on weekends. She tilted her head at me. Joe, you're not afraid of horses, are you?
No, it's just that I... Damn, the last time I'd been on a horse had to be when I was 10 years old. That was only sitting on a horse while it slowly walked around a ring at the county fair. All I remember of that experience was thinking how far off the ground I was, and that if the horse wanted to go somewhere, I wouldn't be able to control it.
Really? You went into space to fight aliens, but you're worried about a horse? I'm not thrilled with the idea of trusting a big, dumb animal between my legs.
Of course, I grinned. You girls just call that prom night.
Joe!
She laughed and slapped me playfully.
You are awful sometimes.
I'm terribly, terribly sorry, I said with zero sincerity.
Sure, we can go on a trail ride. I'd like to try that, I smiled reassuringly.
Being out in the great outdoors having fun with a pretty girl? Who wouldn't enjoy that?
Do you know how to ride a horse?
I shrugged. I grabbed the horse's ears, I pantomimed with my hands. Left hand is the brake, right is the throttle.
Sure, Joe, she laughed again. I would love to get a picture of that. These horses know what to do, and they follow the horse in front of them.
Uh-huh. So all I need to do is sit down, shut up, and hang on?
That's the idea. If you get in trouble, I can rescue you.
Oh, great. The horse ride was a lot of fun, and we took a drive in the country afterward. Gas supplies had recovered enough that most people could resume driving their cars at least occasionally again. Although at $6.50 a gallon, you had to think about whether a trip was worth it. Being a gentleman, I paid to fill up Rachel's car. It was almost painful taking that much cash out of my wallet. The next day was Monday. Rachel had to work, and I had to answer a bunch more questions. That afternoon, she had to fly to Arnold Air Force Base in Tennessee for a conference that would last until Friday morning. It was some computer flight simulator software type thing she was working on. Wanting to impress her, I almost opened my big mouth to say that I was a pilot, qualified to fly a Theranian dropship. Fortunately, good sense stopped me before I blew part of our cover story. Damn, this lion thing was getting old already. She was scheduled to fly back to Dayton on Friday afternoon, but on Saturday morning, she would be leaving for a girls' weekend that she and her friends had been planning for months. My timing sucked, that was for sure.
"I'm sorry, Joe," she said.
"Hey, I understand. I'll be here when you get back. I'm not going anywhere." I was wrong about that. To my complete surprise, the debriefing wrapped up Tuesday afternoon, and the Army granted me 2 weeks of leave. Maybe they figured I deserved leave after our long mission. And it wasn't just me. Major Sims and Sergeant Adams texted me that their own debriefings were over for now, and they were on leave also. Same with the Ranger and SEAL teams, who had been part of the Merry Band of Pirates. My opinion was that we had given UNEF a whole lot to think about, and they needed to process it before bringing us back in for more questions. At some point soon, the Dutchman needed to go back out. Needed to go back out in order to verify the Theranian weren't sending another ship to Earth. I called Rachel and told her I was going to visit my folks for a while, even though I really, really wanted to see her again. And my timing really, really sucked. "You're packing, Joe?" Skippy asked while I was stuffing clothes into a duffel bag.
"Going to see your loved ones?"
"Yeah, Skippy. My parents have been waiting for me to come home since I called them after we jumped into orbit."
"But your loved ones are right here, Joe."
"Huh? My loved ones?" If he was referring to himself, he was still in his escape pod man cave aboard the Flying Dutchman.
"Your loved ones, Joe. You know, Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, Johnny Walker.
Oh, very funny."
"Hmm. Maybe I did have time for a nice drink before I left."
Paradise. Baterna looked up in shock from the document she was reading.
"I cannot believe this. This came from our government."
"Yes, ma'am," said her aide, Pullen Grace.
Grace had been with Baterna Logelia for over a decade, a tumultuous decade. The next year did not appear like it would be any less eventful.
"It is not an official recommendation from the federal government, nor is it expressed as desired policy."
"Yet. It is not yet official government policy. Pullen, this is horrific. I feel unclean even reading this."
"Yes, ma'am," Pullen agreed. And he did agree.
Sometimes his job was to listen and allow the deputy administrator to vent her feelings to a private audience.
"These are people they're talking about, sentient beings. They are a young, backwards, and ignorant species. It's not their fault that they are here."
"Yes, ma'am."
Pullen had done this many times before. After venting her feelings, Ms. Logelia would be ready to discuss policy with a cool, clear head. That was much better than many political leaders that Pullen Grace knew. They let their emotions run their decision-making process. It was understandable that his boss was upset. The report she was reading was radical and shocking. The report stated that the Ruhar federal government, many light years away, was considering whether it would be wise policy for the humans on Gitanu to be sterilized. Permanently. The report inquired into the practical, biological, and political implications of such a policy. It did not inquire into whether such a policy would be morally acceptable.
"If I may guess, ma'am, I think the impetus behind this report was the last status document that was requested by the federal government."
Baterna silently raised an eyebrow.
"In the status data," Pullen reminded her, There were statistics about the human situation. Food supply, how much food they had in storage, how much food they were growing currently, projections of future crop yields. All fairly dry information. The federal government had been concerned about the financial drain of providing nutrient mush to humans. Humans who were technically a client species of the Ruhar's bitter enemies. Within that data were statistics on the human population, and Poland pulled those numbers up on his tablet and showed her. It states there are currently 40 humans pregnant, plus 17 children who have been born since humans landed on Paradise. But Turner was not surprised. Not having the advantage of genetic engineering, human females could not consciously choose when to ovulate.
The government is concerned about such small numbers?
Administrator, I think our government is mostly concerned about the precedent that has been set. When the humans came here, we know one strict condition imposed on them by the Kristang was that all troops were required to use long-term birth control technologies. That policy was strictly adhered to by their expeditionary force until the Kristang lost control of this planet. We do know that the authority of their force command has been called into question by their rank-and-file troops.
Understandably,
Paterna said with sympathy.
They are not only trapped here indefinitely, they have lost all communications with their homeworld. Their homeworld is the ultimate source of the authority for their military leaders here.
Yes, ma'am. We know from monitoring their internal communications, the Ruhar provided the Z-phone network that humans all used, that there had been widespread discussion of whether their society here should have a military structure at all in the future. But Turner sighed.
Very well. The chief administrator will have to reply to this,
she pointed to the report on her screen distastefully.
He will expect me to craft a position for him.
She understood that her boss considered the humans to be a problem for Deputy Administrator Baterna Logelia, because the chief administrator had more important concerns. Yes, ma'am, Poland said, knowing that meant he would be expected to prepare various policy options for her. Fortunately, the two knew each other so well by now that he could guess exactly how she would like to reply to the federal government's offensive inquiry. I will get my people right on it. One thing they were not going to do was inform the humans, unless, that is, the proposed policy was put in effect, and by then it would be too late. Earth.
I called my folks to let them know I would be coming home. I had called them and my sister every day since the Dutchman jumped into orbit, and they understood that I had military duties to take care of before I could see them. Because I wasn't sure how or when I would get there, we agreed that I would get somewhere near Maine and call them again. Being at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, my plan was to try flying Space A to Westover in Massachusetts. After waiting a full day, it became clear that space available on Air Force transports was zero and not likely to improve soon. Someone suggested I could fly commercial. The economy had rebounded to the point where airlines were flying regular schedules again. When I checked on the prices, I couldn't stomach paying that much. Sure, I had a lot of back pay coming. Money earned at a colonel's pay grade and with a hazardous duty bonus. That money was with my parents. But after getting my ass chewed out by UNEF and the U.S. Army, I thought maybe I should make that money last as long as I could in case my military career was over. So I took a bus up to Cleveland and caught a train to Boston. The train was, amazingly, clean and on time. Back when the economy had been in the toilet and there wasn't any fuel for civilian planes, passenger railroads had stepped up and moved people around. It was still a long trip, in a coach seat because there weren't any sleeping berths available. Skippy offered to hack into the railroad reservation system and get a sleeper cabin for me. I declined the offer. In Boston, I did the duffel bag drag across the station and caught a train to Bangor, Maine. This train was a lot slower and stopped more often. The trip gave me time to think. I found myself thinking about Paradise, wondering what people I knew there were doing, wondering if they were still there at all. That wasn't a pleasant thought. My parents, bless them, arranged for a welcome home party for me in the gym of the elementary school. The original plan was for a cookout, but it was raining, so we had a cook-in instead. Having a big party was a great plan, because it allowed me to meet half the people in the town at the same time and answer all their questions at the same time. Telling my story once made it a lot easier to stick to the official cover story. It also helped that UNEF's cover story had been all over the news since the Dutchman returned, so people already knew most of the carefully crafted lies that I told them. Damn, it was good to be home again. My father grilled a cheeseburger for me. It was cheeseburger perfection. Okay, the truth is I ate 3 cheeseburgers that day, which tragically left no appetite for the baked beans, a potato salad, or 3-bean salad, or anything vegetable-related. Did ketchup count as a vegetable? That kind of food I could eat any day. Even though there had been fixings for cheeseburgers aboard the Dutchman, I had only indulged in that culinary delight maybe a half dozen times during the mission. They just weren't the same without being cooked on a charcoal grill. And being on Newark had seriously cut into my opportunity to eat cheeseburgers, because our logistics expert Major Sims had been ruthless about bringing only essential items down to Newark. She did not consider even the most delicious of cheeseburgers to be essential. Not that I'm still bitter about that. Anyway, being back home was great. The only bad part of coming home was that TV reporters had learned that I would be there, and stations from Bangor, Portland, and as far away as Boston were there to pester me with questions. They weren't happy with me because I stuck to the UNEF script. Be boring, I had been advised by the UNEF public relations people. The cover story was that aboard the ship I had been part of the support crew for the Special Forces team. The purpose of the mission had been for the Theranin to train our Spec Ops people in space warfare and to assess human capabilities. UNEF offered the Spec Ops people for TV interviews. They trusted super-disciplined Special Forces types not to say the wrong thing during an interview. Me? They mostly wanted me to keep my mouth shut. "Come on, Sergeant," a Boston TV reporter asked after they turned the mics off. "You guys coming back is the biggest story since the Kristang here got wiped out. You have to give us something," she said with a perfect smile. The station must have figured that an attractive woman would be better able to get me to talk than any of the male reporters. I shrugged. "I'm sorry, ma'am. There is just not much for me to tell. And my role on the ship was to support the Special Forces teams. They got all the fun training, and you know I can't talk about that." She glanced at the cameraman. "I understand. One last question, then." And as she said that, I noticed the cameraman turn the camera back on. Probably activated her mic also. "We've heard rumors that some people have been referring to you as Colonel Bishop. Why is that?" Damn. Fortunately, the PR people with UNEF had prepared me in case someone else slipped up about my temporary rank. Apparently someone had. I laughed. "That was a joke aboard the ship, ma'am. It's an honorary title. I'm no more a colonel than Colonel Sanders is." She looked disappointed. I wasn't. My parents' house looked great. They had the house to themselves again, although there was still a family living in the converted garage. As the economy improved, housing conditions were going back to normal. My parents still had chickens, but they'd sold their cows. The garden looked great. I think they kept such a large garden because it gave my father something to do, rather than driving my mom crazy. "No deer fence in debt?" I asked, surprised.
"The deer population around here got about hunted out during the bad times, Joe," my father explained. "We had a pair of Jehovah's Witnesses come by the house a month back. Your mother suggested we put them to work. Nobody wants to come near them," he chuckled.
"Doing what?" I asked, knowing that I was walking right into his joke.
"Deer repellent. Nobody wants to come near them," he chuckled. And I laughed too.
A couple days later, during breakfast at my parents' house, I was enjoying a hot, fresh cup of coffee and surfing news on my father's tablet. A lot had happened on Earth while the merry band of pirates had been away. First, I checked sports news. The NFL was up to 47 days without a player being arrested. That had to be a new record. There was the usual political BS. I skipped over that. Business. The world economy was on the verge of roaring back. Tech companies were pumped about the prospect of reverse engineering Kristang technology, assuming they could ever figure out how any of it worked. Maybe I could get a shiny beer can I knew to give us a hint. Unlikely, but I had to try it. What else was in the news? Crap. Double crap. First, I had spit hot coffee on myself, the kitchen table, and my toast. Second, the reason I'd spit out the coffee was because I had taken a sip just before reading an article on the internet. Some formerly homeless guy in Vegas had won $3 million over 2 days, hitting up 5 casinos before they all banned him. He had been playing blackjack, and despite the best surveillance by state-of-the-art casino security, there had been no evidence that this guy had been card counting or cheating in any way. In fact, based on interviews, it appeared he wasn't quite clear on the rules of blackjack. According to the article, it had been an incredible run of luck. Monkeys, of course, had no idea what luck really is.
"Joey, is everything all right?"
my mother asked, handing me a napkin so I could blot up the coffee that was soaking my formerly crisp rye toast. "Yes, Mom. I need to make a quick phone call," I said, as I picked up the coffee cup and a piece of toast, giving her a kiss on my way out the door. It was misting rain, so I stood on the front porch. Putting in my Z-phone earpiece, I made a call.
"Oh, Skippy, I need to speak with you, please."
"Sure thing, Joe. What is it?" he asked with a too innocent tone to his voice. It was almost certain that he had been monitoring my web browsing, so he knew exactly what I had been reading. "There's a funny thing I want to ask you about. Some guy in Vegas won a ton of money playing blackjack."
"You don't say."
Skippy's tone was not convincing. He needed to work on that.
"Hold a minute. Let me scan the internet for pertinent news."
"Yep. Yep, I see it now. Wow, that is amazing. You never know, huh? What a lucky guy. That's why Vegas is the land where dreams can come true, I guess. Amazing. Yeah, that's one word for it," I said, biting into soggy toast. "You wouldn't, know anything about this, would you? I'm only asking because you are an incredibly amoral, sneaky little beer can."
"Joe, that hurt. Although perhaps amoral is accurate, since what happened in Vegas was neither moral nor immoral."
"Uh-huh, that's debatable. So you were not involved in any way?"
"Involved is such a vague word, Joe. Aren't we all involved with each other? At the quantum level, everything is..."
"You know what I meant, Skippy. I will ask a very direct, non-vague question. Did you help this guy rip off 5 casinos?
"This guy? You mean a Navy veteran who had medical problems and had fallen on hard times?"
"Mr. Ronald Brown certainly deserved a run of good luck in his life. I'm surprised at you, Joe. Considering that you are a soldier, I would think you should be happy to see a veteran enjoying good fortune."
"Don't try to change the subject. I am happy for Mr. Brown. What I am not happy about is the good fortune part. It's not luck when you're cheating, Skippy."
"Cheating? Evening the odds somewhat can't be considered cheating, Joe. Casinos always have the advantage in blackjack. If a player starts to win, the casino can end the game by shutting down the table. The only way for a player to even the odds is to do the same as the house. Walk away from the table. Walk away before the game begins. The house always has their thumb on the scale. What was wrong with me helping an average guy do the same thing?"
"Aha! So you did do it then."
"Damn it," he muttered. "How in the hell do you ever manage to outsmart me?"
"Joe, when something like that happens, I sense a great disturbance in the force."
"Your guilty conscience tripped you up, Skippy."
"Ha! That is a good one, Joe. No freaking way would I ever feel guilty about this. What did I do wrong?"
"You ripped off 5 casinos, Skippy."
"Pfft!"
He made a raspberry sound. "Like they're ever going to miss that paltry amount of money. Besides, technically I did a huge favor to those casinos, to the entire gaming industry. In fact, they should be thanking me."
"Okay. Man, this I have to hear."
What convoluted logic was he going to dream up for this one?
"Go ahead. Try to spin your way out of this one. It should be amusing."
"Amusing? You mean instructive, right?"
"Joe, the entire gaming industry is based on conning gullible people into getting ripped off when they know they are going to get ripped off. If all the mooks out there used their monkey brains, Vegas would go out of business in a week. Casinos need to give people fantasy, the fantasy that somehow they, against all odds, will win. The fantasy that losing is for other people, not them. There are millions of suckers across the USA and beyond who will read that article about Ronald Brown winning millions. They will want to cash out their savings, pack up the car, and take a road trip to Vegas, baby. Because if Ronald Brown did it, it can happen to them too. Seriously, Joe, I've been monitoring communications of casino executives, and they're all playing this up for maximum publicity. They're leaking to the media that they banned Ron from playing their tables because Ron has a secret system for winning at blackjack. Every sucker out there thinks he or she has a secret system, too, and the casino execs know those people will be flocking to their casino soon. So, everybody wins. Except the suckers, of course. Nothing I can do about them. I mused. Bottom line, then, you did this to help. Out of the goodness of your chrome-plated heart. Hopefully the tone of my voice reflected sarcasm. Exactly. Well, that plus I'm bored, Joe. Oh, man. I took a sip of coffee and looked out at the softly drizzling rain. The forecast called for the rain to go away by noon and become a nice, sunny day. Skippy, last time we were here, you chatted with, like, billions of people. Didn't that keep you occupied? Yes, and I'm doing that now. Joe, I could carry on simultaneous conversations with every human on this planet and not use more than 2% of my processing capacity. Way less than 2%, in fact. I need a challenge. Because of enforced inactivity, I have already had to put most of me into dormancy. It would not do for me to get into mischief. Would not do? If ripping off casinos didn't meet Skippy's definition of mischief, then I was afraid to see how much trouble he could get into. Please, please, do not get into any more trouble, Skippy.
I'm not sure I can promise that, Joe.
Oh, and hey, I'm sure you are too busy to read stories about interesting things that happened at casinos in Hong Kong, Monaco, and other places over the past couple days, right? No need for you to trouble yourself about such trivial matters. Also, you don't play daily fantasy sports, so don't pay attention to that either, although some guy named Stippy is totally cleaning up there. Oh, I have created a monster. If UNEF found out about Skippy's larcenous adventures, I was going to be in serious hot water. It was not my decision to stop at this miserable mudball you call home again, Skippy pointed out. You know how easily I get bored. Fine. Can you give me a few days to think up something interesting for you to do? While I doubt you will find a way to entertain me, sure, I'll give you 5 days. Great. No pressure on me. Now I needed to save Earth from Skippy. Paradise. To seek glory in battle is glorious again emerged high above the planet's southern continent, although this time not as far from the surface as before. Indeed, the little frigate was below the altitude at which it could safely jump away, a fact that greatly concerned the ship's crew and captain. When the mission had been explained to the crew, the captain had been forced to reassure them that the Glory, its crew, and its captain were not out of favor with the task force commander. Quite the opposite was true. The little ship had been so bold and so successful in its previous missions that Glory had earned the honor of becoming the lead ship of the raiding force. The crew should be immensely proud, the captain had declared. The crew's justifiable pride was tempered by their intimate knowledge of Kristang culture and their well-informed understanding of the military situation in the battle space around the planet Pardassus. They knew the Glory's boldness and success were not the only, or even most important, reasons their ship now had the honor of another high-risk raiding mission. The key factors why they were once again risking their lives, while the other task force ships safely drifted in deep space, were unspoken, but known to everyone aboard the frigate. Glory was a frigate, the type of ship most numerous in the Kristang fleet. Frigates made up the bulk of the fleet because such ships were cheap and quick to construct, and they did not require large crews. A frigate could carry the same type of missiles as a battleship, although much less of them, and some frigates were even outfitted with a railgun, every bit as potent as the railguns of a larger combatant. What frigates lacked were heavy shields and the ability to carry more than a dozen missiles. Frigates also rarely were equipped with energy-draining damping fields, both because the reactors of most frigates could not generate sufficient power, and because any frigate foolish enough to get close enough to an enemy to use a damping field was usually soon a dead frigate. So, the crew of the Glory knew they had earned the honor of another raid, mostly because their ship was among the most expendable of the task force's few ships. The other reason was deception, to conceal the true size of the Kristang task force. Each starship broadcast a unique jump drive signature, and by now the Ruhar were very familiar with the signature of the Glory. To rotate raiding duties among multiple frigates would eventually tell the Ruhar how many ships were in the Kristang task force. The purpose of sending a destroyer on the last raid was not just because a destroyer's heavier weapons could cause more damage on the surface. It was also to force the Ruhar to devote more ships to the defense. A mere little frigate could be dealt with by one defender. Chasing away a destroyer required a prudent commander to commit at least two or three ships. That prior raid had been entirely successful. The destroyer had inflicted significant damage to Ruhar facilities on the surface. Both the Glory and the destroyer, we are proud to honor Clan Subliner Rosh Atal Vergent, who inspires us every day, had gathered vital intelligence about Ruhar defense tactics and capabilities, and the raid had forced the defending Ruhar ships to pull closer to the planet, concentrating above the vital northern continent. Of the known Ruhar ships defending the battle space around Perdassus, several were now stationed at such low altitude they could not quickly jump from their positions. That left only three ships capable of freely maneuvering to quickly intercept raiders. All that was good, and the Glory's crew did feel prideful when they were not wondering how many raids they could conduct before the odds caught up with them. None of them, not even the captain, were from families sufficiently high-ranking to warrant a troopship being named for them after their deaths. All the pride in the galaxy would be cold comfort after a Ruhar weapon penetrated their thin defenses and exploded the Glory's reactor. So it was with a great amount of unspoken fear among its crew that the frigate emerged above the southern continent and immediately began boosting at full power for greater altitude. The frigate had emerged below jump altitude in order to provide a tempting target for the Ruhar defenders, but the ship's captain had no desire for a suicide mission. Although the task force's support ships carried equipment for maintaining jump drives, it was inevitable the drive would slowly decay and fall out of calibration on a predictable curve without service at a full space dock. Already, the Glory's drive was operating at only 92% efficiency, and that increased the distance the ship would have to climb away from the planet in order for a successful jump. As the frigate frantically clawed its way out of the planet's gravity well, with the crew considering throwing things overboard to lighten the ship, its maser cannon began firing rearward at the southern continent. Tuned so the beam covered a broader area of the surface, it shifted from one target to another. Targets were scattered across the surface, and the maser was pointed at areas without heavy cloud cover to maximize the destructive energy delivered to the surface. Although the targets were widely spaced apart, they were all of the same type. Fields of human crops. The maser beam scorched wherever it struck, burning out entire fields and withering plants that were close to where the searing beam struck. Humans in the fields died. Others who were lucky to receive Z-phone warnings after the initial strike scrambled to get under cover. The Ruhar commander waited perhaps too long before dispatching one of his high guard ships to chase the frigate away. He had been wary of another enemy trick, and wary of another tongue lashing from the planetary chief administrator if another raid struck the northern continent. If he had acted sooner, he might have caught the enemy frigate before it jumped away. He did note with interest that the frigate waited until it had climbed beyond minimum jump distance before it disappeared. The Ruhar sensor network detected telltale signs of a deteriorating jump drive. That was an interesting fact that he would file away for later use. For the immediate moment, he needed to answer a call from the deputy administrator, who had received a harsh communication from the human expeditionary force leader. Over 40 humans had died in the attack, an attack which the Ruhar defenses had done little to stop. If such attacks continued, the human leader warned, the ability of humans to feed themselves would be in doubt, and the Ruhar lacked enough nutrient mush to feed the human population for more than a few weeks. The Ruhar on Gitanu also lacked the facilities to produce more food for humans, which means more would need to be shipped in at great expense, and at great risk, for a ceasefire in the sector was still being negotiated. Bringing in food for the humans would require several large cargo ships. Those ships would need to be escorted by warships, and those warships would have to be diverted from urgent combat duties. The Ruhar fleet commander thought to himself that his dreams of stationing his ships at Gitanu would be a pleasant, if brief, respite from combat, were fading away with each successful enemy raid. Earth. The next day, both of my parents were at work, so I had the place to myself. To keep busy, I went out to the barn where my father had been working on the tractor. While I was fixing the brakes, Skippy called me. "Hey, Joe, I need your help with something." "You need my help."
I wiped my hands on a rag. Since when? Now I sense a great disturbance in the Force. Since now, the idiots at UNEF have assigned a diplomat to negotiate with me over bringing that troop ship back. The guy is seriously irritating me, and I want you to talk to him before I do something he might regret.
Skippy, the correct expression is before I do something that I might regret.
There was a distinct pause before he responded.
We may have another communication problem here. What I'm talking about, Joe, is laying a serious smackdown on a jerk who is pushing the limits of my patience. I wouldn't regret doing that at all. Hell, I'd buy a ticket to see something like that. Now, he will very much regret it if he pushes me over the edge.
How do I explain human expression to an alien AI?
The expression means that you might regret overreacting. Might regret doing something you later realize was going too far for the situation.
Damn, your human expressions are so confusing. Anyway, as Hannibal Smith of the A-Team said, overkill is underrated.
It still amazed me that Skippy took so many cultural references from crappy TV shows.
It's an idiom, Skippy. You know what an idiom is, right?
Sure. An idiom is something idiots say, instead of saying what they really mean.
This conversation wasn't going anywhere, I decided.
All right, who is this diplomat?
I've been calling him Chuckles the Clown.
There was no way for me to suppress laughing at that.
Chuckles the Clown.
It is appropriate. His real name is something like Charles Winthrop Douchebag the Third. I shorten Charles to Chuck and then... Well, you'll understand when you talk to him. Hey, I'm calling him now.
Hello?
A voice said. Then there was the sound of a phone hitting a tile floor.
Oh, blast it,
the voice said, followed by the distinctive sound of a toilet flushing.
Skippy, I whispered, you called this guy while he is in the freaking bathroom?
In negotiations, throwing your opponent off balance is a time-honored practice, he answered smugly.
Why won't this bloody thing turn off?
The voice said with a British accent.
Heidi-ho there, Chuckles. It's me, Skippy the Magnificent, and Colonel Joe Bishop is on the line also. Say hello, Joe.
Hello, Mr. What was his last name? I was pretty sure it wasn't exactly Douchebag, but maybe it wasn't Winthrop either.
Winthrop. Charles Winthrop.
To my ear, he said it like Bond, James Bond.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. Winthrop, I said politely.
Likewise, Sergeant Bishop. I have been very impressed.
Hey, Skippy broke in. He is Colonel Bishop to you, Chuckles.
Skippy, it's all right, I said quickly. It was no surprise that negotiations with our alien AI friend had not been going well.
I'm a sergeant down here, and I'm proud to be a sergeant. Mr. Winthrop, Skippy tells me you have been attempting to negotiate his help in bringing the Krestang troopships back into Earth orbit.
That is correct, Mr. Bishop, he said.
His diplomatic training must have told him that calling me Mr. was better than sergeant.
We have made several generous offers, Skippy broke in again.
I have considered your most generous offers.
That was sarcasm, in case you need a translation. The answer is no, and hell no.
As a diplomat, Winthrop surely expected that no was merely the beginning of negotiations. He didn't know Skippy the way I did.
Smoothly, calmly, he continued,
Mr. Skippy, I am sure that through good faith negotiations we can reach a compromise that both parties can accept.
Hey, Chuckles, Skippy interrupted. Why don't we take a break while you find a dictionary somewhere? Look up the word negotiation. I'll give you a hint. Negotiations occur when each side has something the other side wants. The power dynamics in negotiations affect the outcome, because the party who needs what the other side has is the most willing to make concessions. The power dynamic in this case is that you, meaning humans, absolutely must get what I have. What I have is a way for humanity to be warned of and possibly prevent hostile alien ships from coming to Earth. Your failure to secure my assistance in these negotiations, yes, I was using verbal air quotes there, would be disastrous for your species. I'm talking fire, brimstone, railguns, pounding your cities into dust, all kinds of traditional biblical-type apocalypse stuff. Except, maybe not plagues of locusts. I have never known the Krestang or the Theranin to use clouds of insects as a weapon. Although there's a first time for everything, right? Anyway, back to the subject. You, on the other hand, have something I am only, mildly interested in. If a fleet of outrageously pissed-off aliens comes to Earth and wipes out you humans, I can go dormant and wait for the cockroaches to evolve. Mr. Winthrop, Skippy, I attempted to explain. as kind of a thing about cockroaches replacing us as the dominant species on Earth. Skippy snorted.
If Chuckles the clown here keeps trying to negotiate with me instead of getting to the freaking point, then clearly cockroaches are moving up the ladder by default. You had better start welcoming your new cockroach overlords now, Joe.
Chuckles lost some of his carefully practiced diplomatic cool. I could hear his voice tighten.
Mr. Skippy, surely you understand that...
By contrast, Skippy's voice was cheery. I surely understand that I have no incentive to negotiate with you or anyone about anything. You monkeys need me. I don't need you for anything.
Mr. Skippy, you assuredly do not need our help. Our assistance would be, as you stated, merely a convenience. Our need for you is similarly not an absolute. We are capable of sending a team up to retrieve that troop ship,
Winthrop responded frostily.
What we propose is an agreement to provide convenience to both parties.
Oh, sure, Skippy snorted. You could send up a tin can to rendezvous with that ship eventually. You won't be able to get in, though.
This is very embarrassing to admit. Joe locked the keys in it.
I told Joe that we should hide a spare set of keys near the reactor, but did he listen to me?
No, big stupid head. You could have an astronaut try jimmying the door open with a coat hanger, I suppose.
Chuckles laughed. Whether he was genuinely amused at my expense, or his diplomatic training told him when it was appropriate to laugh, I couldn't tell. While he was laughing, I took the opportunity to interject a comment. Mr. Winthrop, I appreciate that you must be under tremendous pressure to reach an agreement. Based on my extensive and close experience with the ancient alien superintelligence we call Skippy, I described him that way to remind Chuckles who he was attempting to negotiate with. That is simply never going to happen. Skippy is right. We do not have any leverage with him. Our taking the Dutchman back out is a convenience to him. But he has waited millions of years already. He kind of really can wait another million years if we piss him off. He knows that we can't wait to send our pirate ship out again. There could be another Theranan ship on its way here right now. Skippy knows that. I'm sorry, but I think UNEF has put you in an impossible situation here.
Thank you for the frank assessment, Mr. Bishop.
Chuckles' voice was smooth again.
Perhaps we should all consider the situation and resume this discussion at an opportune time in the future.
That would be a good idea. Skippy surprised me by saying that. Then he went back to being his usual self.
For the sake of efficiency, when we resume the discussions, instead of you contacting me, how about you talk to yourself in a mirror? That way you won't waste any more of my time and avoid the consequences of me getting seriously annoyed at you. Or if you don't want to talk to a mirror, you can use a sock puppet.
Winthrop had regained his balance and smoothly responded.
Clearly your time is extremely valuable, Mr. Skippy. Mr. Bishop, perhaps it would be better if you and I spoke directly.
Ah, crap. If UNEF had assigned Winthrop to negotiate with Skippy, the next step would be ordering me to work with him. This was going to ruin my whole freaking week, at least, and there was no way for me to avoid it. Winthrop would make a politely worded request to UNEF Command, and they would contact the U.S. Army, and the Army would order me to help Chuckles the Clown.
Certainly, sir. It would probably be best for you to go through my commanding officer.
Except that I had no idea who my current CO was. The 10th Infantry Division was stuck on Paradise, as far as I knew. When they promoted me to colonel, I was temporarily attached to a headquarters unit, and I reported to a general who was still on Paradise, as far as I knew. Actually, my unknown chain of command could buy me an extra day of freedom. I was wrong about an extra day of freedom, because Major Sims called me that same night. We had seen each other only twice since we landed. Both of us had been stuck in debriefings. We had texted via Z-phone, but that's all. Sims had good news and bad news for me. The good news is that she had recommended me for a Bronze Star, but she had been told that since my meritorious action had occurred during an aerial flight, the paperwork had been changed to a Distinguished Flying Cross for my solo space dive. Because our mission was secret, I wouldn't be able to wear either medal on Earth. But it was a nice gesture. On the other hand, I'd been recommended for a medal before in Nigeria, and nothing had come of it. The bad news was that my leave was canceled, effective immediately. I had to drive down to Bangor that night. An Air Force transport would be flying me back to Wright-Patterson.
UNEF Command had thought about the situation and decided the Dutchman needed to go back out ASAP. That made me wonder if their foreheads hurt from slapping themselves over such an obvious decision.